This conference is being recorded.
This is Iacocca Teleclass number 3. Doing a quick roll call. We've got Steve Hall, Ramon, we've got Eric, we've got Doug, we've got Brandy, we've got Peter, and we've got Jeff.
Yep.
So starting this call, I think we're all pretty good with the ground rules in terms of no multitasking. If you have your implementation plans up, please use them or bring them. If you have your materials in front of you, even better. And we'll try to keep this a dinner table conversation, so not folk. With that, I am going to lead off with wins. And in particular, I want to get a little bit more color on Peter's win.
Yeah, so I talked about how we had some struggles in the purchasing department as far as structured meetings and we recently, as I discussed, we introduced a new scorecard that is helping with our game filming sessions, helping go a little bit more efficiently, has all prevalent information that we need to see, and we set a time, we actually had allowed for an hour, but we were pretty efficient. We were able to get through everything we needed to go through in 45 minutes, and the scorecard that Jeff put together has really made it a lot easier to reflect on how we're performing. And as far as why it went so efficiently, for one, Lear didn't storm off upset, but two, I think we knew what we wanted to see, and we were able just to get through what we wanted one by one. And, the buyers were prepared with questions that they had and things that they wanted to see. And I think it just comes down to being focused and prepared and having an objective for the meeting. And we were very clear and focused about what we wanted to accomplish. And that's why it went so well. So I'm hoping to build on that. Typically, I game film with the buyers on my own, but I'm probably going to talk with Jeff about seeing if we can do that regularly with him, because I think it's helpful to have him involved to get his insight as well, just to make sure that we're all aligned. So, but anyways, it was a big win, and I really think it just came down to being focused and prepared about what we wanted to achieve.
Nice. I appreciate that, and especially appreciate the mutual sort of focus on objectives or agenda, right? One of the things I would think about is, even game filming with the people who are in the meeting, about the meeting, to help reinforce the lesson. Hey, what did you think about the meeting? Did you think it went pretty well? I did too. Why do you think it did? Oh, it was an agenda. You start to slowly build a stronger foundation of everybody sort of moving in the same direction. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
So, just a suggestion. Anybody else got some wins that they want to talk about, speak to?
This is Doug. I've had now the opportunity for two dynamic agendas that I used with my meeting with Steve on Mondays, and I found that what it's done for me is kept me focused on what I wanted to talk with Steve about, what my, where I wanted the meeting to go. It also allowed for him to, add, things that he wanted to discuss with me. And because I think my agenda was tight and I knew exactly what I wanted to talk to him about, that it then afforded us the time to be able to have dialogue about, things that he wanted to talk about. And I found really those are probably the two best prepared meetings I'd had set up because I had really taken advantage of my weekly focus and was able to, put it together and say, okay, these are the two most important things that I want to talk about this week. So I think it was a win on both of those, weekly focus and the structure of the meeting.
Yeah, this is Steve. Doug sends out his dynamic agenda ahead of time, and so if there's something I want to add to it, he allows me an opportunity to add. And we actually, our hour meeting, first time we had, we finished, we had about 10 or 12 minutes left, and so we were able to have some dialogue before the meeting, and right after that, his end, the exact time Brandy started, Brandy had a dynamic agenda, and we were able to cover a lot more and got a lot more time and ended on time. And when I didn't use my dynamic agenda with Jeff on our call yesterday, and our 1 hour call went an hour and 50 minutes. So you can see the difference because we got into a lot more discussion, and it was very helpful and very deep, but it wasn't as structured. So I did get the experience both sides of operating with the dynamic agenda and without it, and it was a big difference.
Awesome. I'm going to just do permission to be messy real quick before Brandy jumps in. Jeff, I want to check in with you about that meeting. Would you
Which one, the Steve's meeting or the Peter's meeting?
Well, both, but Steve's in particular because he mentioned, hey, his impression of it was less structured. It didn't flow maybe as well as some of the other ones that used or benefited from the dynamic agenda. Just want to check in with you.
Yeah, and that's true. Right? We got into some very big, broad subjects, which, on reflection are so big that they actually warrant, a dedicated, structured meeting that just to focus on those issues. Because if you're doing an hour long meeting and you've got, three items that sort of as a metaphor are like curing world hunger, it's, the most you can really do is sort of scoot over the top of, bound the issue and then agree to meet outside. So I think that the lesson for us is to really either focus on one by pre-agreement or agree that those issues exist and then agree a path forward for how we're going to solve them and how we're going to meet and really dive deep on them and afford them the time they deserve.
Mm. Gotcha.
But in under 2 hours, we did solve world hunger and malaria and the educational system in the United States. So it wasn't
That's
all
awesome.
That.
We just need to figure out how to roll it out and we're good to go, right?
Yeah. For the third time. For the third time. Yeah, we
get it down in an hour.
Well, what I'm going to think about the dynamic agenda is what I like is it forces me, like I'm looking at one of them right now. This was mine, Steve's particular one. It forces me to tie it to something on the 2x2. And if I can't tie it to something on the 2x2, then is it really even something we want to be talking about? Like when I'm saying I need to delegate culture items. Well, why did I have to do that? Because I was working on the MPS project, which was on a 2x2, develop and drive MPS promoters, right? So if there's not a reason to talk about something that didn't tie into the 2x2, it lets me kind of leave that stuff off, and then we're really only talking about the stuff that we both know we're supposed to be focused on anyway. So just in using the weekly focusing time to prepare that agenda and make sure that everything is tied to something that this whole team has agreed is one of the most important things that we need to do as a company. It allows for the space to really just work on the most important things. There's a lot of stuff that Steve and I could go off and kind of chat about, but it wouldn't really be getting anything, done. And so that's where I think that it also helps a lot is tying to those executive team items for the 2x2.
Yeah. I tend to agree. I appreciate you sharing that and making that connection because a lot of times it's lost on executive teams that we work with that, I'm in a meeting and there should be some connection to some 2x2 if it's really integrated all the way through. for some of these meeting topics. Now, if it goes off of the topic, that's okay, but it probably means that it's an emergency or there's something that's truly popping up or bubbling up, and it warrants consideration for how it should be addressed, at least even within respect to the 2x2, i.e., should it go on there or not, if you, especially if you see it continually coming up or repetitively coming up. So thanks for sharing that. Anybody else have any other wins they want to share? Okay. Well, I'm going to jump into some quick warm-ups. I asked on Monday, shot out an email, said, hey, deliberate trade-off, that whole module might be worth reviewing, especially prior to this call. So I'm going to start by just simply throwing out the question. I'm going to ask you guys to answer as it comes to you. So I'm not going to call people out specifically, but speak when you think you got something you want to say. What do deliberate trade-offs really mean?
It's about prioritizing, specifically prioritizing and evaluating alternatives and making conscious choices. So, you know, there's going to be several different important objectives and items that you want to achieve, but it's about ensuring that you spend your time on the things that are most important and making a conscious effort to really understand what is most important, because time is a valuable asset that you have to use, and there's only so much of it. So if you prioritize and get the most important things done, you'll be able to have the most impact with the time that you spend.
Yeah, that's a great answer, and I certainly appreciate this notion of what are you consciously saying yes to, right? The flip side of that is, what are we saying no to regularly, and why? And that's just two frames.
That's the hardest thing to do is to say no.
Yeah, I agree. Why is that? Why do you think that is? This comes into the next question, so I'm curious.
I think this is Doug. I think it's, at least in my career, I've always been working in a company where it's a servant management style. You know, someone comes to you with a problem, you help them with it. Now, whether it's capturing it as a teachable moment or if it's actually giving them the answer directly. And then I think for me to say no, and I'm trying to, I guess I'm being a little messy here, but for me to say no, I feel like I'm letting down the staff or the person that had came to me, has come to me about it. And I think that my image in their eyes is going to diminish, like, Doug's not very helpful. Every time, don't go to him because he'll say no. And so I have a hard time balancing when to say no or when to redirect if it's something that I know I could do. And I think my trade-off is, well, I'm working on maybe a project or I'm doing something right now and someone comes up and asks me, my trade-off is to stop doing, what I was focusing in on and stopping and to help them do something that I could have redirected maybe to another, person, Eric, a sales leader, Brandy.
Yeah.
I just want to really agree with Doug that I don't know if I've ever heard it like actually said that well, but how I feel is that it's not that I think I have the best answer for everything or I'm the best person for everything, but when someone specifically, especially if it's my boss, but I mean really just colleagues in general, ask me, I always feel like, well, they're asking me for a reason, and that's not always true. I realize, but I don't want to appear as if I am afraid of work or don't want to, take on additional tasks or don't want to, or that my usefulness or will actually, diminish in someone's eyes. Now, what I've seen, though, is that the trade-off that you make for that is sometimes your effectiveness diminishes in someone else's is because you have taken on too, you know, too much. But I think, you know, I started reading The Power of Positive No, but I still have a very hard time. I think one hard reason, or one reason why it's hard for me to say no, is also because at the surface, sometimes things seem like that is something I can handle. Then you take a couple steps into it, and you're like, well, not in this time frame, or, you know, no, I should not have gotten myself into this, you know, like.
Right.
The question itself seems like, okay, well, yeah, that's in my wheelhouse, and that's something I should handle. But then you realize you're not going to be able to turn around what you consider to be something you'd be proud of, or I, you know, I find that I'm, like, worth pulling an all-nighter trying to pull it off because I never wanted to tell somebody that, you know, I couldn't produce something that I would feel really good about in that time frame because I've already said yes. Right now, I don't want to go back and say no.
Right.
You know, and that is also something I struggle with is looking at. Well, Steve and I've talked about it. Is trying to tell someone, can you give me a? Do I have to do this right now, or can you give me a minute to think about it? Because sometimes, probably even in 15, 20 minutes of exploration, I could. Know whether or not it's something I could really have the bandwidth for, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, so here's one thing that I'll throw out there, right? High achievers usually have trouble making deliberate trade-offs for a couple reasons that we've seen at least. One is usually they have a proven track record of success, right? So they always make the impossible happen. They're the hero award winners, et cetera. Most of you, you know, in on this call, all of you on this call, have some feature of that, otherwise you wouldn't be on this call. The second part of that is just you've risen to success by stretching limited resources, which is oftentimes a high characteristic of mid-market companies. And so you make a lot happen, a lot of great things happen at a very high level, usually through a lot of heroic effort, right? That makes saying no to things a lot harder because it's like, yeah, I can totally do that. I've always done something like this, right? And all of a sudden, as you get higher and higher up at a company, or as the company starts to get more deliberate about what trade-offs they're going to have, you got to be very focused because the stakes get higher and higher, right? Deliberate trade-offs are super important for mid-market companies specifically because you don't have a ton of resources, whether it's capital, staff, time, et cetera, to go invest in things that aren't going to necessarily work, or you got to be able to pivot very quickly when they don't, right? So.
This is Ramon. You know, to jump in on that, you know, coming from a operational standardized work type background and even military and things like, sometimes saying no, it the perception to somebody from that type of background, that mindset, is saying I failed by saying no, I can't do it, and so I think that's why sometimes. I know I struggle with saying, no, I can't do it. And then what I don't realize is when I say yes, I probably didn't think it completely through because, like you said, we've done this before a million times and just one more time, and probably I could just do it like I did it the last time and get it done. But the reality is not that because what I realize is if I'm saying no to only one thing but yes to 23 things, then – I've actually just set myself up for failure. That is the failure, as opposed to saying, no, I can't get it in right now, or not following the 5 D's, you know, do, delay, disregard, you know. And so saying no sometimes from the person saying, having to say no, that's the failure piece, as opposed to not realizing the failure piece is actually saying yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a tough thing, right, because especially in the military, what triggered me was the military background, right? Militaries work really well a lot of times because of the system that's in place and the teamwork that gets implemented. That's ultimately what a maturing organization needs to start focusing on, especially in the mid-market, is you guys have a great team of executives who are often very heroic and who can get a lot done, but if you're going to actually go accomplish more than you've ever accomplished before, yeah, they got to find more people to be on the team who can do exactly what you're doing, which, you know, oftentimes does not yield the results you want, or you got to figure out how to create the system. And so think of it as is a no with a purpose, you know. It's really the basis of the power of positive no. So flipping over real quick to open-ended discussions, another thing I'm curious about is this notion of working on the business versus in the business and executing initiatives that are on the business versus in the business. Can someone walk me through or at least start us off with a discussion of what they think working on the business is versus what's working in the business?
Yeah, hey, Rupert, Eric. I'm sorry I was late. I did a lot of thinking on this, reading this last night. I actually came down here and closed the doors for an hour by myself, and I only got interrupted 7 times. Imagine that. I have been working in the business way more than I need to be. It's the evils of my environment. I'm on an open floor plan. I've got a desk readily accessible, and I can hear everything on the floor. And I've got this board sitting to my right that says a number on there. I've got to sell X number of cars today to hit my goal, right? So I'm surrounded by all this stuff, and I can hear all this stuff working all day long. You know, hey, is the Smith deal going to go? Is Jackson going to come in? And I'm sitting there pushing to get the cars on the board or get the end product of selling the cars, but I'm doing it from a task-oriented approach versus a on-the-business, higher level of thinking, got to get more out of my people, got to give clear delegation and clear direction, I guess, is where I'm looking at, right? So I've got to start working at the higher level if I'm going to ever crack the magic number and get more out of my team, because I've got more on my plate than I've ever had, and I can get it done, but it's going to burn my ass out is where I'm going. So I need to start working more on the business at a higher level than being in the business, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the business, in that situation, I'm going to play it back to you what I heard and tell me if I'm right or wrong here, or tell me if I need to adjust what I think I heard, which is, in the business is how do we sell more cars right now, physically actually going and doing the process of selling more cars.
Yes.
On the business is the system by which the team gets more cars sold, however that may be.
Bigger view, longer-term planning, bigger vision, correct.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's exactly right, that designation. So what are some other examples for you guys in your respective areas of working on the business versus in the business? So, and in particular, Ramon, I'm curious to hear from your perspective what's on the business versus in it.
Well, you know, here's the interesting thing. It's kind of like Eric, you know, coming from the conditioned background that we came from, it was actually okay to teeter-totter between the both because, you know, like Doug said, the servant leadership and things like that. And so I had a self-discovery, you know, reading the text, and then after recalling our Tuesday morning meeting and listening and absorbing what Steve was talking about, it kind of clicked and made sense to me. You know, working in the business is that ground level action items that produce the output of the person who is working on the business that set the vision to be. And so I found myself getting distracted because I'm wanting to show my guys, hey, I know what you're doing, and I'm going to do it along with you. And then I let that distraction take me into the business a little bit longer than I needed to be. And then,
right.
And then it took me away from being able to work on, you know, the business plan, our principles of production, and embedding those things. And then when I turn around and I look back, I'm like, damn, I didn't get to accomplish, you know, half the things that I wanted to, or, hey, I'm a little bit behind because I was working in the business of, you know, making sure Andrew's doing this or making sure this is going that way. And, hey, why don't you try to do it this way? And then I get into showing them, and I'm doing those action steps to getting the end product as opposed to working on the business and being that business owner saying, hey, with this vision, if you did it this way and do it that, you know, I find myself getting pulled back and forth because I'm doing those action items as opposed to, you know, embedding the plan and setting the culture, setting the pace. And, you know, so that's my kind of example of it. It's, you know, in it is doing the action. On it is setting the vision, setting the pace, the plan, motivating the people, keeping them moving. And that's kind of what I got from it. And working on it allows you to prepare. Working in it keeps you from preparing, and now you're reacting as opposed to being proactive to setting it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Something that you said kind of struck a chord with me, which is on it for you is literally showing your guys how to do something. Or in it, sorry, is showing your guys how to do something. On it would be training or creating the training program so that it's institutionalized and they know how to do it through the training program. Does that make sense? And that's the designation. Anybody else have any other examples?
Sure. Mine is kind of different. My job has I'll just call it evolved in different directions as the business has needed that. So what I have is when I'm working is almost like a perception thing. You know, if I'm working on the business, like take for instance like the new the plan for the new website is going on. Well, no one knows I have a deadline tomorrow for artwork. I have a deadline on Friday for you know, mapping out the wireframes. Because no one's going, well, what's going on new today with the website, Brandy? So what I have is this perception that no one really knows what I'm doing, right, until something's really done. And so I feel like every now and then I have to pop my head up and work on something where people see my face, you know, that generally isn't as important. It's like, oh, okay, well, we need to put a new culture board up in the collision center, or you know, always something that's not probably as important as the stuff that I do to work on the business. But my stuff working in the business is, and I think probably for everybody, is more visible. People see you doing the daily grind with them, getting work done with them. It's almost like you have to explain why you're having to work on something that no one understands what you're doing at the time. And I could almost see that with every person in here. You know, when you remove yourself and take the time to work on the business, just like Ramon was saying, you're not working, you know, shoulder to shoulder with your people. You're creating something bigger, right, that people don't see the benefits of immediately. And so, you know, there's a little bit of pressure to make sure that every now and then I'm working shoulder to shoulder with people so that, you know, I don't have people wondering what the hell I do, you know, until a new website comes out or a new, you know, oh, now we're all in green on promoters or whatever.
Right.
So that's, you know, kind of the issue I see with working on or in. One of them is more impactful to other people, but the other one is actually more impactful.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on perception and your relationship to the perception of how everyone else is sort of viewing the role, right? But at the end of the day, on versus in is never going to be a complete 100% one way or the other. There's always going to be some balance and some shift. And it's really just making sure you're cognizant of what choices you're making when you're making them. Right.
This is Jeff. I mean, from my observation, for particularly people like Eric and Doug, I'd say to the two of you, the decision on how you allocate your time between working on and working in is probably, for me, one of the most, if not the most important decision you'll make, because too much in either direction and you will fail, right? So finding that balance point is really important. Working too much in the business, you're eventually going to, as Eric said, burn out. Working too much on the business, you won't achieve your short-term goals and you know, fail on the business objectives. So that balance is, I think, the most critical, important decision. To help you achieve that balance, something that I've done and I've had lots of people do in the past is really spend some time actually documenting in real time, like a consultant or a lawyer has to account for 15-minute blocks of their day. Actually document how you spend your day. Because what we often done this in the past many times is you actually unknowingly train your people to come to you all the time and suck you into the working in the business. And, you know, I've got that. Leave that with me. I'll do that. You know, yeah, I'll come. Yeah, I've got that. And those, every one of those instances is you actually training your people to treat you like the middle of the hourglass, and you become then the bottleneck to growth of the organization. So I think two things. One, really think about your balance of time, and two, I would encourage you to kind of to actually document the decisions you're making and how you're spending your time for, you know, a week or two, just to step back and say, do I really need to be embroiled in all this stuff, or can I actually empower my people and then ask for feedback, set up those kinds of mechanisms?
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. And I think, Steve, you'll recognize this is like very similar to a walk the talk exercise, where your values, and, you know, in the ILP, just to make it very personal, in the ILP we ask people to write down their values and then actually put their time up against the things that they say they value versus how they actually spend their time. And what you find is that there's usually a gap of some sort. And this is very similar to what Jeff's suggesting, which is if you actually start to measure out the time you spend in a day, how much of it is really in versus on, and how much of it is unconsciously in to create a systemic issue, which is being bottlenecked and sort of training people to come to you. It's a provocative question that, you know, I think will leave for reflection, because I'm curious to see how people, what their relationship is to that over some period of time. Shifting in real quick to the 2x2, I want to get somewhat tactical and walk through sort of the main sections and how you guys relate to the 2x2 and what you really think it means versus, you know, sort of your colleagues. So if we think about the 2x2 as a tool to help us make deliberate trade-offs, what is your definition of work in?
Well, I guess something that's important to the business, but can't necessarily, it may not be as important as some other things that we're selectively investing in. It's something that ultimately we want to get to, but we may not have necessarily the resources or the time to get it done now. And that's essentially how I see it.
Okay. I heard a couple different metrics of value here, and I'm going to go deep a little bit, but I heard importance, right, measures of importance, relative importance. And then I heard another metric of value, which is just, you know, actual value or cost or time, right?
Yeah.
Is importance, how do you guys gauge that, relatively speaking? How do you tell which thing is more important than the other?
I do it by return on investment. The time that you're going to need to do it versus the cost versus the gain.
Okay. So the value. Right. You said return on investment. Importance is just a proxy for value at the end of the day, right? So if we think about work-ins, because what I notice as a pattern, as we've done this with a lot of different executive teams, is that they get caught up on the words, the things we call these buckets, as opposed to the true sort of reasoning behind why they're in certain quadrants. And at the end of the day, work-in is things that we have deemed of low value and, you know, relatively low cost. Does that make sense?
Yes.
They're not hard to do per se, but they aren't going to yield as much as they've been written. What about selectively invest?
High value, high effort.
High value, high effort. Time frame come into that at all?
They're typically longer-term goals, they're not something that you'll accomplish by driving daily. It's something that you're going to have to set a time period, whether it be a month or a quarter or maybe even a year. They're something that you don't know currently how to obtain, but something that you can work towards obtaining over a certain time frame.
And I think the time frame component is an interesting question to me, because time frame oftentimes is simply a proxy for costs or effort, right? And it also typically is also a proxy for, you know, how much value you get out of things. But if you guys have a high-value thing that's only going to take 5 months to do or 6 months to do or 1 month to do, but it takes a lot of push and it's a sprint to get there, it absolutely deserves to be in a selective invest, even if it only lasts a month or three, right? So the time horizon is just indicative of, again, most things that are going to be of high value and high cost usually take a lot longer to do, but it's not always the case. What do you think the commonality of, and this was something that we had talked about in the work session, and I'm going to, you know, sort of, what kinds of problems go in working and selectively invest? We briefly mentioned it in the work session, but, and I don't expect you to pull it up directly, but I'm just curious. What do you guys think? What kinds of problems? Or what kinds of initiatives?
I think to selectively invest, those are initiatives that are, I think, more global to the company, that unto itself, it's kind of like, where do we want to go? That it's the direction.
Okay. So big, strategic, I hear that. Okay. Any other suggestions, any other thoughts?
Selectively invest is working on the business, where I see you drive daily more working in the business.
Okay, interesting designation. Why do you think drive daily is working in the business?
It's something that you routinely do day in, day out. For instance, with my pricing strategy, while there are certain instances where I can work on the business as far as an overall pricing strategy, I still have situations where I work in the business where I'm constantly reviewing specific examples, where I may have been underpriced or something like that. So, if we see that we're lower on gross, if I'm making adjustments, I'm reacting to maybe an issue with the strategy, but it's working in the business because at that moment I'm not necessarily changing my overall pricing strategy. I'm reacting to a problem that exists at this point in time.
Okay.
So things that I'm doing daily to refine that process, I feel like I'm working in the business. And then overall, though, my pricing strategy would be working on the business to ensure that some of those mistakes that have happened, if I can then work on my overall pricing strategy, that would be working on the business instead of, looking for specific instances where I may have made a mistake.
Yeah, and so what I'm hearing is variances in scope, right? Something that's more task-oriented versus something that's maybe a broader, larger issue. What if I called Drive Daily low-hanging fruit and I got rid of the time component of the name?
Yeah.
I just call it low-hanging fruit. How does that change, or does it change, how you think of all the initiatives that would go into that quadrant?
Well, it's a lot easier to make changes to, on price to singular cars, whereas, developing a strategy for how you price, 300 cars and keep aging in check and all that, that takes requires a lot more focus, energy, effort, and a longer time period.
Okay. Does it have high value?
Yeah, it has higher value. The overall pricing strategy does have higher value because if you're able to invest in that time and getting it right, then there's less reactive time where you're going to have to make changes to individual prices.
Right.
So investing in the overall strategy is really going to save you time in the future. If you can get that right, then I won't be in the situation where I'm reacting to one-off situations.
I also look at the difference, low-hanging fruit, like for me, is taking something that's maybe in existence and using the knowledge that I have to tweak things that are going to make a really big difference. To me, I just have been working on the NPS project. Low-hanging fruit is a drive daily for me, once I was able to get into it, was taking the survey, changing the wording, changing the subject line. Those are things that I already know how to do. I was doing it from an existing program that was already there, and just tweaking it to make it better. And it produces a lot of results, with not too much. It's work, but I consider it low hanging fruit. It's there. It's existence. It's something I know how to fix.
Yep. So that's interesting, right? I mean, I think that this notion, I just want to revisit this pricing strategy because I appreciate where you're going with this kind of little tweaks. What I heard was pricing strategy is an overall strategy, selectively invest because it takes a lot of time and effort. It yields a lot of actual value. The review process of individual pricing issues, while still derives higher value, it's lower effort, and therefore that's why it would be drive daily. And this designation is really how do we create the system and then shift it over into the drive daily or low-hanging fruit, which is maintaining it and making it a daily part of our culture or a daily part of our routine activities, right? Still high value in keeping them up, low effort to maintain them. And I think that's what you're getting at, Brandy, which is you got the big part done, which is the survey and the system. Now it's tweaking to yield better results.
For me, it's
strategy is definitely a selectively invest because that requires so much preparation and also maybe getting into unfamiliar parts of the business. There are certain things that are familiar to someone and there's unfamiliar parts that may require pulling other people together, other resources together, going 3 weeks and feeling like you didn't really make that much progress, until that fifth week when you're like, okay, now I have, whereas the drive daily and the low-hanging fruit, you can see progress pretty quickly.
Yep. Jeff, what were you saying?
Yeah, I was going to say, for me, I think I mentioned before that a crystallizing statement was what Wes said when we were at the workshop, which was not just add the word incremental to effort. And so, for me, when you and I think drive daily, low-hanging fruit is actually for me a better heading for that quadrant because using Brandy's example, updating, revising the survey was something she knew how to do and was actually good high-value item, but required little incremental effort. In Peter's case, the running of the pricing every day is the sort of base job, knows how to do it, not incremental effort. If we said that we need to analyze everything to date and really rebuild a strategy, then I think that would require a lot of incremental effort, a lot of incremental time to be freed up. So it was the word incremental for me that really helped me identify which items fell in which quadrant.
Yep. That's great.
Hey, Rip, it's Eric. I was going to say, Jeff hit right on where I was going. If you take the time and do all the effort on the selectively invest and you get it right, you can move it over to the drive daily quadrant if everything's in place because it ends up working itself through once all the processes are done. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's actually exactly right. This notion of slowing down to speed up, right? Get it all right in the selectively invest. Go ahead.
I just improve overall sales process and customer experience, right? It's a very grandiose, very labor-intensive product that Jeff and Steve and I and Doug are working through right now. But once we get those behaviors and that process in place, it can push it over to the drive daily. My drive daily for me is, you know, 3 to 4 posted appointments per CEO per week. But if you fix the selectively invest on the left side, you can move it to the right, and then that takes care of itself, and you can work on something else or refine it or whatever that looks like.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about just capacity to hold initiatives, the drive daily are low-hanging fruits, typically because they require less effort or less incremental effort. You can hold a lot more of those than to selectively invest. And you're just looking at your 2x2 right now, you guys have 5 things in selectively invest and roughly 11 things, I think, 10 things in the drive daily. That's actually a pretty decent balance. Now, I don't know anything about the full amount of things that would go, you know, effort, real effort that goes into each one of those, but the relative number, right, kind of seems about right because of the fact that the hard part is the figuring out and the setting up and the working through. The maintaining is really where the drive daily sits.
Yeah, Ruth, this is Steve. One of the things that my experience with the 2x2, when I first started out doing it, there were some different definitions, but as I got a little bit more clear on those, the thing I always wrestled with is you can get the definitions right and you can get the placement right, but where I found that I was running into trouble was even though I got the placement of the initiatives in the right box, I didn't get the capacity right. And so you tend to overestimate what you can do on the 2x2 in a given year. And
yep.
So it ties back to deliberate trade-offs. And one of the ways that I did about 6 months ago is I looked at the 2x2 as a 12-gallon jug. And I just came up with that number just off the top. I said, I've got a 12-gallon jug. Anything that I put in to selectively invest is 2 gallons of water. And so if I have 3 of those selectively invest in my personal 2x2, I've now filled up the jug 6 gallons. Then if I move over to drive daily, those are 1 gallon. And so I then put in, let's say I put in 4 of those. Now I'm up to 10 gallons. Then if I move into work in, those are 0.5 gallons. So I only have the capacity to do, once I reach my 12 gallons, everything goes into either the delay or the ignore bucket. And if something comes up, so I start off with a 12-gallon bucket. And the reason why the jug helps me is because it not only gets it right in the beginning, but if something pops up, I know I've got a 12-gallon jug that's already full. So if a new initiative shows up, I don't just stick it on the 2x2. If I put it in the drive daily, I says, okay, that's a gallon. I either got to remove 2 work-ins and put those into delay, or I got to move 1 of my drive dailies and put that into delay. So if I keep it, it helps me as new things come in. I never overflow my bucket.
Yeah, I love that metaphor of the bucket and the capacity, right? And the last part of what you said is to me the most resonant, which is not all 2 gallons are created equal. And all I'm doing is creating the ability to say, if I find a 2 gallon initiative that's really worth it, it's going to cost me something else. And at least take myself through that series of trade-offs in a structural way.
This is Jeff. Something that we've wrestled with and we didn't do, and I'd be interested in your guidance. Was the 2x2 was set out as a kind of an annual 2x2 at company level, and if you take the big selectively invest programs, you know, improve sales operations, say, what we didn't do was then break that down and say, what does that mean specifically for quarter one in regard to actions and deliverables, yep, in quarter one? And so one of the things that we're wrestling with, I think, is and it comes back to the question of working in and working on the business, how how would you advise that we take the 2x2 from our at our retreats to say, look, you have this big selectively invest program. What's the next steps for breaking it down into, say, now quarter two deliverables and actions and owners, so that we can then actually have those on 2x2s and make sure we've got the right resources allocated and making those deliberate trade-offs?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that actually gets to the core of what we're going to be covering in advanced execution going forward, right, which is why this basic foundation is so important. If you guys have a complete fluency with the 2x2 now, you'll be able to start making these kind of next steps. So in the next quarter, we're going to be talking about roadmaps and how to actually break down initiatives into focus areas and then roadmaps based on quarters to get specific things done and how all of the 2x2 will start to nest within departments.
Yeah, that's where I was going, Jeff, is that let's say we have improved sales operations. Then what we do is okay, that's the company initiative. For Q2, let's break that down. What are the improvements we want to make? And so those improvements may go on the selectively invest for Eric and his sales. If there's certain things, maybe, recruit 3 more CEOs, right? It may be something to do with the follow-up on the NPS. That might be Doug and his training. It may be increasing leads. That might be on Brandy's 2x2. So I think a lot of this, to me, is it's the next level is broken down, is identified at the retreats. Is here's what the improvements in these areas we're going to make, and they end up on the a lot of those end up on the departmental or the individual 2x2s. And some of them, could move into the drive or the low-hanging fruit section of the corporate.
Yeah, we're going to go deep into a lot of the work structuring components, Jeff, that you're speaking about, especially when you think about the 2x2 and these initiatives as a strategically invest or selectively invest. What are all the things we need to be thinking about for an initiative to get done, and what's the time frame we want them to get done by, and who's actually going to go do them? That's what we want to drive for. Yeah.
One of the questions that we had yesterday that I was hoping to get clarity on is this exact topic is the breakout. And the example I was using in Brandy's marketing 2x2, she has a selectively invest for the year as implement successful implementation of a social media strategy, right? That means she has to research it, she has to write the plan, she has to test the plan, she has to implement the plan, monitor the plan, and then have that all done over the course of the year. The first, so that's on her selectively invest for the year.
Got it.
The first step is to actually do the research and write the plan, which is due by March 31st. So that's due in the next 30 days, right?
Yep.
Where would that – does that even go on the 2x2, or is that just an initiative under the selectively invest that we know and we use a template that Jay created for us, or do we actually put the write the plan, add that on the 2x2?
It's a great question. I think that there's a multiple way. There's a few different ways to answer it, but the very simplest is, okay, so implement social media strategy as the selectively invest. I may even adjust language and call it build and implement a social media strategy, and that's the selectively invest. Now, if you just take that initiative and then go to a different sheet, which we're going to teach you as a focus area and a roadmap, then all of those relevant steps have a place and a document that she can then hand off to relative members of the team. She can run her own initiative rhythms on, whatever it needs to be to actually go get that through. And the first of which is research, due by a certain day. So there's probably sub-steps to researching, right? It's benchmarking. It's basic analytics. It's all the tools we would use, et cetera, right? All of that kind of breakdown. Go ahead.
So that's like the project plan they showed in the ILP?
Yeah, it's very similar to the project plan that they show in the IOP. We're going to take it a step further and probably bring it up a level of detail to allow, at the very least, a nice summary for you guys to have to discuss as the basis of your review, but also a method for her to then go implement with the team. I know it's team of one right now for this, but it is very similar to the project plan, yes.
Okay. So it wouldn't go on the two-by-two. It's just it falls under a template or document that is part of the selectively invest.
Right. So, you know, in my debrief with Jay from yesterday, one of the things he said is brand strategy was one of the, call it selectively invest for the two-by-two at the corporate level.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily see it on the 2x2 that was sent out, but let's assume it was there. So that sits at the corporate level. Now, if there's a specific subcomponent, which it sounds like it is, which is implement and build social media plan as part of the brand strategy, that's a selectively invest for Brandy, who's working on that in her department. You could actually have an initiative level 2x2, which we'll teach later on in the year, which breaks out all its components and put all of the relative parts onto a 2x2 for an initiative only.
Makes sense.
Rube,
so there's a few ways to skin the cat based on the need.
Rube, I was in the reading, and I'm just trying to relate and tie this into what I read, because I was thinking about that conversation from yesterday, and on page 13, I thought that kind of fell into framing, and it's,
yeah.
There's no fundamental aspect of the project that's omitted. It's all inclusive. But the granular task of that action is not omitted, but it can still be worked on, but it doesn't have to be on the form itself. Is that correct?
Right. That is absolutely correct. So I'll give you an example. A lot of times we end up working with manufacturing firms, and executives of manufacturing firms are oftentimes engineers. And engineers always come to us with an initiative plan that's 700 Excel lines deep and 45 Excel lines wide, and they expect someone to be able to come in and have an absolute view of where the project's at and what needs to happen. And frankly, the level of detail is just too low for anyone to really function at the executive team level in any reasonable way. You aren't expected to know all the nth degree of detail for Brandy's initiative, for instance. So at the level you guys are at, the right level of detail is part of the trick, gauging what that level of detail is. Now, if Brandy has a team and she has to break the subcomponents down into specific areas, it's going to get more and more granular. But that's okay, because more than likely there's a junior and more junior level of employee who's going to be helping her execute these tasks, and they're going to need specificity of the task. So it's gauging what your audience is and where the right level of detail is. But you're absolutely right in terms of the framing. And we're going to go through a framing initiative in Q3, I believe, but it's not going to include every nth degree of task. It's going to provide the guiding sort of high level, and it's going to assume that we're going to be able to go take those and break them down into sub-initiative meetings or whatever they are. This is really how it then ties back into the dynamic agenda, for instance, because you can just have the higher level part on the dynamic agenda with the sub-parts being what you're actually going to execute day-to-day, week-to-week, whatever. Does that make sense, guys? This is all great questions, by the way, and I want to encourage you to continue to dive deeper into the 2x2. If you are absolutely not clear on how the 2x2 works and all the trade-offs and all the nuances of it, by the end of this quarter, we're going to have to do some catch-up in Q2. So we have to make sure we're all fluent in it, because it only builds from there. And we're at time, by the way, so I want to just notice the time. I can keep going for a little bit longer if you guys need to, but just notice the time is 9:30.
I think we can wrap up. I think the big thing that we're deliberately not going to do this year. Delay means we just are going to defer it till determined time frame later. We haven't decided. We got the work in. I think the real area of difficulty for the team is, where is that line when something crosses over in that middle upper quadrant from drive daily or low-hanging fruit to selectively invest? I think that is where it gets a little unclear, is how are we about. We know the definition of incremental effort or incremental cost, but where is, you know, how are we defining effort and cost, right? And I think that's where we'll probably need a little more coaching.
And Rip, I have one just real specific, going back to what I talked about earlier, because I felt like I made it with a low-hanging fruit probably too easy in thinking about it from selectively invest to low-hanging fruit. When I was first given the project of the NPS project, the Net Promoter, our survey tool, our customer experience tool, it was selectively invest because it took me probably 2 to 3 weeks of real reaching into it to see what levers I could, you know, how everything was set up. I was not familiar with the survey system we use. I was not familiar with the flow of how surveys were sent out. I was not familiar with anything about the project. I was just given the project. But about 3 weeks in, all of a sudden it was like I taught myself the survey tool I had taught, and then it quickly moved from what I would consider a selectively invest into a drive daily. Like, I had the scope, I understood what levers I could pull. So it did not originate, actually, in what I would consider a low-hanging fruit or drive daily. It took, you know, 2 to 3 weeks of really familiarizing myself with the components. But then, because it was completely in my wheelhouse of things that I know how to do and have done well in the past, it became a drive daily. And I guess, is that just a natural metamorphosis of how things can happen? Now we can put something different in my selectively, I can move something from ignore to selectively invest or from work into selectively invest. Is that kind of how that would work?
Yeah, that is. So if you guys look at slide 11 in your materials on the 2x2 and deliberate trade-off, it's called the life of an initiative. We go through sort of it's very high level, but I'm going to pause on that, and I think this is really good fodder because Jay is going to come back in next week, and I think this is exactly what you guys want to be talking about, or what are the criteria, what are the things that move an initiative through the relative parts of a 2x2, and why? And I think getting at least similar language on what you guys think it is going to be really useful as we continue to progress through the year.
Anything we should be working with? How would you coach a team over the next 2 weeks, what is it that we should be doing for the next teleclass?
For the next teleclass in particular, I want to continue on the 2x2 because it's that important. What I would consider doing is looking at your own 2x2. I have a copy from what Jeff sent out 2 days ago, I believe, or yesterday. Think about these initiatives on a relative basis to one another. I want it to be where you guys are tired and you start to complain about the 2x2 because you're just tired of talking about it. That's how
people can they email you?
Yes. Actually, if you have questions, put it on the e-journal, and Jay and I will get to them.
Good.
We will both answer, but I think everybody can benefit from all the questions. If you feel like there's a question you just don't want to share with the group, by all means, email us. But if you think that the group can benefit from the question, send it to the e-journal. All right, guys, that's our time, an incredibly meaty discussion. I appreciate the engagement. I appreciate the participation. I'm really looking forward to the next iteration of this in 2 weeks, and I'm also looking forward to debriefing with Jay on how this went and then how his coaching session is going to come up next week.
Yeah. Thank you, Rupert.
Thank you,
Rupert.
All right, guys, thanks.